Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 20, The Dynasty of Peru, Text Number 22. Retoda Putra Nayati.
Retoda Putra Nayati.
Naradeva Yama Shayat.
Naradeva Yama Shayat.
Tvam Chasya Data Garvasya. Satyam aha Sakuntala. Retada. Person who discharges semen. Putra. The son. Nayati. Saves. Naradeva. O king Maharaj Dushmanta. Yamashayat, from punishment by Yamaraj, or from the custody of Yamaraj. Tvam, your good self. Cha, and Asya, of this child. Data, the creator. Garbhasya, of the embryo. Satyam, truthfully, aha, said, Shakuntala, your wife Shakuntala. So this is a voice from the sky. O King Dushmanta, he who discharges salmon is the actual father, and his son saves him from the custody of Yamaraj. You are the actual procreator of this child. Indeed, Shakuntala is speaking the truth. Purport. Upon hearing the omen, Maharaj Dushmanta accepted his wife and child. According to Vedic Smriti, Punnamo Narakad Yasmad Pitaram Trayate Sula Tasmat Putra Iti Prokta Swayam eva swayam bhuva. Because the son delivers his father from punishment in hell called put, the son is called putra. According to this principle, when there is a disagreement between the father and mother, it is the father, not the mother, who is delivered by the son. If the wife is faithful and firmly adherent to her husband, when the father is delivered, the mother is also delivered. Consequently, there is no such thing as divorce in the Vedic literature. A wife is always trained to be chaste and faithful to her husband, for this helps her achieve deliverance from any abominable material condition. This verse clearly says, Putro Nayati Naradeva Yama Shatyat. The son saves his father from the custody of Yamaraj. It never says, Putro Nayati Mataram. The son saves his mother. The seed-giving father is delivered, not the storekeeper mother. Consequently, husband and wife should not separate under any condition. For if they have any child from whom they raise to be a Vaishnava, he can save both the father and mother from the custody of Yamaraj and punishment in hellish life. The philosophy of Krishna consciousness is quite exact, although even so-called devotees don't necessarily accept it. But actually, they're so-called devotees because a devotee, as Prabhupada writes in the Nectar of Instruction, he accepts everything that Krishna says. He accepts the philosophy in totality. In other words, that's called faithfulness, as Prabhupada writes in the Nectar of Instruction, in the fifth verse. Instruction is to accept the Bhagavad Gita in its totality. And indeed, the Bhagavad Gita is the basic principle of all the other aspects of our philosophy. Even here, as it says, Dharma, what's it? Kulashek pranashami kula dharma sanatana. Dharma nashta kula kritsna madharma vivat krishna. When the elderly members of the family become killed, then the ladies become corrupt, and from such corruption comes unwanted progeny. Kula Shaye Pranashanti Kula Dharma Sanatana. So if the elderly members of the family are killed, then dharma, religious principles, are also forgotten. Kula Shaye Pranashanti Kula Dharma Sanatana. Sanatana means that eternal principles, they can't be changed. Although currently in society people think they can do whatever they want, they can go against all the laws of material nature, and that this body is simply meant for sense gratification, and however, whatever the body is attracted to, it's all right. As long as you gratify your senses, you're doing fine. In other words, there's no God, there's no purpose. Asatyam apratishtam te jagarahuri nishram aparashparam sambhutyam kimanya kamahaitukam. They say the world is unreal, no, with no foundation, no God in control, is produced of sex desire, and has no cause other than lust. So if something goes against the modern understanding of whatever you feel like doing, you do it, because there's no karma, there's no reaction to what you're doing, then if people think like that, they still get the reactions anyhow. They may imagine anything. As Prabhupada said, in Bengali there's a statement, just like a madman, just like a goat can eat anything, so a madman could say anything. So this idea that men and women are exactly the same, and that women should be exactly like men, and they can do whatever they want, and it's all right, because there's no God, there's no laws and control, that these things were made up. And therefore, scientifically, we've proved that everything came out of nothing, and everything enters into nothing, and therefore you don't have to worry about anything. So their philosophy is nothing, and what they're going to achieve is nothing also. That's why they don't have to worry about anything, because they have nothing to worry about. Except for the fact that after death, they get the reactions to their activities. This idea that there's no soul and that there's no reactions, we're already getting reactions. The soul is already getting reactions from his past activities. And when he gets the fortunate human form of life, he's supposed to learn what dharma is, at least. Otherwise, he suffers. That's why people suffer. Because irreligious activities lead to the destruction of cleanliness, mercy, tolerance, and truthfulness. And with them comes illicit sex, meat-eating, intoxication, and gambling. So all these people who have this philosophy that you can do anything you want, they do whatever their senses demand in them to do. They don't do whatever they want because they don't know what to do, except to follow the dictation of their senses. And therefore, although they claim that illicit sex is fine, and that women and women can separate from men, there's no responsibility for the children, etc., etc., you just do whatever your mind dictates to you. But, although it may be socially acceptable, but it's not very pleasant for those who are involved in it. That even in the spiritual world, there's relationships between males, being Krishna the eternal male, and females, and they're dependent upon Krishna. Except for the Parakiya Rasa in Goloka Vrindavan, at least in the Swakiya Rasa in Dwarka, the queens are faithful. There's no such thing as separation. When Rukmini heard that, when Krishna was joking with her, and he said he was going to separate from her, she became quite disturbed and even fainted. She didn't say, "Well, that's fine. I was always looking for a new husband. It gets tiring being with you eternally. Might as well try something else for some time." No, she became greatly disturbed. And Krishna had explained to her that he was only joking with her. Because at least if the relationship is founded upon actual true values, then the relationship will grow and it will become nicer and nicer as time goes on. And if the relationship is based upon simply temporary sense gratification, they'll get stale very quickly, and therefore there will be separation. But as explains here, the problem with that is that there are laws of nature that will determine where we're going in our next lifetime. And if the man is not adherent to Vedic principles, then he's going to go to Yamaraj. If he doesn't bring up his children in Krishna consciousness, then it's a great sinful activity. And there will be no one to save him. The children certainly won't save him because they won't be able to save themselves. They become versions of cats and dogs. It's training children to play video games and to act like experiment with sense gratification. It means that the parents are just have no idea what their responsibility is, and they may think that they're saved because they're aspiring to become devotees, but they also get the reactions for not properly training up their children. Just like one man was going to be hung because he was a criminal, but he had an aunt who was always very lenient with him throughout his whole life. So at the time he was going to be hung, he called over his aunt to whisper something into her ear. And she came over and he took his mouth and bit her ear off before they hung him. So she was quite shocked. And he said, because you never trained me properly, therefore I'm in this position now. So we have to know what our responsibility is, and we have to do it to the best of our ability. But if we don't even know what our responsibility is, and even if we know, we don't accept it, we just, that's just some old philosophy. Due to social pressure, whatever, due to bad association, we just take the Vedic literature, just some social, old social idea, and make some philosophy so we can reject it. Then the result is that material nature will not be very kind to us. It'll deviate us more and more from everything else that the Vedas say, and therefore it'll be impossible to chant Hare Krishna. If the relationship between men and women are not proper in this world, and unless one is a greatly advanced devotee, then the relationship between everyone else will be improper also. Because from lust comes greed, comes anger, comes illusion, comes bewilderment, forgetfulness, comes loss of intelligence. And the material nature doesn't make an exception. It's not that we can act lustfully and avoid becoming greedy or frustrated or illusion or forgetful of real knowledge and therefore lose our spiritual intelligence. It doesn't work that way. If we improperly utilize lust is meant to propagate children to raise them in Krishna consciousness. If we don't utilize lust properly, then we'll be carried away by the material nature. It's very stringent. And even one can't control his senses, at least one should make some endeavor or someone recognize that actually not a very advanced devotee, therefore I don't have enough spiritual strength to control my senses. Therefore one should at least feel regret rather than making a philosophy that justifies whatever my sense gratification is. That's the most dangerous thing, is creating a philosophy that justifies one's deviations. Because then one will never correct oneself. Then it will be impossible to make any advancement, because one will be convinced that my deviation is actually the right way, and one will continue to deviate until one disappears. Just like one devotee, he decided that he would concentrate on the holy name, So he got a harmonica stand and wrote the Maha Mantra on the harmonica stand. So wherever he was, all he'd see was the holy name. So he'd chant his japa, and he'd walk around the temple room with his harmonica stand and the holy name, chanting, fixing his mind on the holy name. Then he decided it didn't work, so he started to walk around the temple, chanting the holy name. Then he walked around the block. Then he walked around two blocks, and one day he walked around and he disappeared. Never saw him again. Because he came up with his own methodology, but it wasn't the proper methodology. So we think we can invent our own way. We got to do something new, something creative, something that no one else does. Then the result is that Maya will, from such creativity, will help us fall into the mode of passion, where creativity is welcome, and which will lead us into ignorance. Trying to become profit, adoration, and distinction is not a very, it's just a manifestation of material desire. Because like I said, I was distributing books at the Charlotte airport, and at that time I was distributing books with a devotee who was number 3 in the world. I was like number 20 or something, distributing books. Small airport. But he'd only stopped the most beautiful, well-dressed ladies. And if you filmed it, you'd think there was some kind of Romeo meeting Juliet in the airport. But he inevitably gets some large donation from the lady, because he was very romantic, and he gave her a book. And that went on for some time until finally he met the woman he was looking for, and that was the end of his book distribution. So he was looking for something, and Krishna sent it eventually, because when one develops the desire enough, then Krishna will fulfill it. So if we don't get the right philosophy, we don't understand things properly, and we don't accept it, the right relationship between men and Krishna, women and Krishna, women and men, if we don't accept that philosophy, then what else are we going to accept? How much do we actually know about Krishna? How much do we actually see the laws of karma acting? How much do we have any real experience in reality? But this reality is always facing us all the time. The reality of how women relate to men and how men relate to women. It's a 24 hours a day in conditioned life experience. And unless there's some adding of Krishna consciousness to the relationship, and when we say Krishna consciousness, not that we see Krishna standing with his flute everywhere. Like with Kamsa, when he saw his two wives, he remembered Krishna and Balaram. He was so aware of Krishna, so much afraid that Krishna and Balaram were going to kill him, that when he saw Prasuti and Shruti, he took out his sword to kill them. Krishna and Balaram, now you're slain. And they said, wait a second, Kanks, we're not Krishna and Balaram, we're your wives. He said, oh, I'm sorry. It's... So not that we're going to see Krishna and Balaram everywhere, but at least we should understand that Matrivat paradareshu paradvareshu losravat. When we look at a woman, the minimum for civilization is to see a woman as like one's mother, except for one's wife. And every woman should see every man, conversely, as like her son, except for her husband. So that's the beginning mentality of human civilization, becoming human. What to speak of understanding that every woman is Krishna's servant, just like we are. Every living entity is Krishna's servant. There's a soul in every body. Some souls are more conscious of Krishna, some less conscious. But in any case, everyone is Krishna's eternal servant. And one should treat everyone as a servant of Krishna. One should respect everyone as the temple of Vishnu. Just like when we come to the temple, we pay obeisances, because the deity is in the temple. So every living entity we should pay respects to, because not only the soul is in their body, but the super soul is there also. samam sarveshu bhuteshu tishtantam parameshwaram vinasyava nashantam yapashyati. One who sees the Supreme Lord accompanying all living entities and knows that neither the soul nor the super soul within the destructible body is ever destroyed, he actually sees. So one should respect every living entity as a temple for Vishnu. And one who sees the super soul accompanying all living entities and knows that the super soul is equal everywhere doesn't degrade himself by his mind and thus approaches the supreme destination. So with that vision, with these visions, then we can actually act properly. We can restrain our senses and our mind and try to make some progress towards utilizing them in Krishna's service. Otherwise, our minds are always trying to deviate us, and we're accustomed to it due to bad habits of being deviated. So we have to just form good habits, and gradually our mind will be able to, it'll be conquered by placing Krishna there. And then we can have proper relationship between at least husbands and wives, so they can raise nice children in Krishna consciousness, and therefore their problems at least will be solved. We may not be able to solve all the problems in the universe, but at least we can solve our own problems by properly having proper relationships between husbands and wives, and if we're not married, at least between men and women, and everything. So that relationship is necessary. That we can work on. That's easier to work on than fixing our mind constantly on the Supreme Person. Although that's also nice also. But at least we should know that these are things that take our mind away from Krishna, and therefore we should work on trying to establish a society where these things are accepted and practiced, understood, accepted, and practiced, so that we can actually have an example of a human civilization, and not just imitate the karmis because we think it's going to be respectable. They're going to the darkest regions of hell, and if we imitate them, we'll go along with them, that's all. Chanting Hare Krishna all the way. And maybe when they're torturing us in hell, they'll give us some japa beads so we can chant. So I'll stop there. Thank you on that happy note. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. There's two different questions. One is about, you said that you gave this example of this devotee who was doing big but not in the proper way. And so how can we, what can we think if someone is doing big, like he's distributing a lot of books? Can we say this is a spiritual potency, or sometimes not the case? Not.
No, it's definitely not necessarily spiritual potency. One can think about Krishna and not distribute any books, or one can distribute books and do it for out of false prestige. See how wonderful I am by practicing. There are people who sell encyclopedias, many of them. They're not necessarily spiritual. They distribute a lot of books. So there's some material ability that comes that Krishna gives the intelligence for, especially if one is fortunate enough to distribute Prabhupada's books, and Krishna will give intelligence how to do it better and better if that's what one wants. But the reason why we want it is maybe different. If I want it for my prestige, Krishna may give me the intelligence. He may not. But I may have gotten that intelligence my previous lifetimes. And therefore I may be more expert. On the other hand, if we want to do it to please Krishna, to help bring his other children back to the spiritual kingdom, then Krishna is much more likely to give us intelligence, so we become better and better. But if at any point we become proud, we start thinking, I'm the doer, I'm great, I'm so wonderful, I'm so empowered, then Krishna will generally take that away from us, if we're sincere. And if we're not sincere, he'll allow us to develop our false ego to the point that we think, well, why should I do this for Krishna? I might as well do my false ego is just to do it to satisfy my false ego. Why sell books? I can sell cars and make a lot more money. That's generally that we've seen that happen in our movement. Why sell books? Why not sell paintings? You get five euros for a book, you can get 300 euros for a painting. So that sometimes the leaders think that our aim of life, our aim of this movement is to make money and get the most opulent temple, or whatever, the biggest prestige. And they have all their book distributors go out and start selling paintings or candles or incense. And the result is that the devotees get accustomed to selling paintings. They lose their spiritual taste. The motivation is obviously not to bring the children necessarily. It's hard to think that by giving them a Hong Kong painting, I'm going to bring them back to the spiritual world. So then they start losing their taste for sadhana, for spiritual life. And they think, why should I bother selling this for the temple? You know, why not sell it for myself and my family? So there's many varieties of possibilities. So one has to simplify things and make sure that when we're doing it to bring Krishna's children back to the spiritual kingdom and not to get a score for my prestige. Or simply to get money so we can expand the temple. No, our aim is to distribute transcendental knowledge. That's the highest thing we're doing. Everything else will come by Krishna's arrangement, as much as Krishna wants. But our aim is to distribute transcendental knowledge. Everyone that we meet is Krishna's servant. And we're fulfilling Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's instruction to us, Yari Deka Tari Kaha, Krishna Upadesh, Amara Aga Guruhana Tari Desh. Whoever we meet, we want to tell them about Krishna. Krishna Upadesh, to elevate them. That's our objective. Yari Deka Tari Kaha, Krishna Amara Aga. That way we can actually be properly situated. Anything else? Yes.
Hare Krishna. On the point of seeing or trying to see Krishna everywhere within everything, this point is a little close to me. So I'm thinking sometimes it's also explained in the way that we can mechanically see, like we use our intelligence, see Krishna within everything, but how we respond to things is that we respond to the form and to Krishna. In the sense that everything, Prabhupada explains that everything, this, Krishna's energies, they make different forms, and when we look around, everything is some sort of form. We believe that form exists in our philosophy. So then, you know, person is single, that's a form. They're married, that's a form. Someone was nice to me, that was form. Someone wasn't that nice to me, that was form. I have nice career, that's a form. I have career that I don't like, that's a form. So then, you can see Krishna within everything, but responding, you have to both, to Krishna's presence and to the form itself in the right way. Otherwise, then there are examples of people who are advanced.
Or this is a statement. Are you giving a question, or are you making a statement on your idea of what, how to see Krishna's form? Is this a question?
I just wanted to I didn't mean to be like a question. I meant
Well, let me say something. If you want to see Krishna everywhere, it begins with accepting that everything belongs to Krishna. If we don't accept that basic principle, our idea that we're seeing Krishna everywhere is a mental speculation. And then if we accept that everything belongs to Krishna, then we have to find out what Krishna wants us to do with his energies. We have to find out what Krishna wants us to do with his energies through his representatives, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. And when we do that service faithfully, if we do it to please Krishna with bhakti, then Krishna will help us remember him. And then we'll be able to see him everywhere. So as much as we understand the philosophy of Sambandha and engage in abhideya service, the idea of prayojana, loving Krishna, then to that extent Krishna will gradually reveal himself everywhere all the time by revelation. Anything else? Khala Grantaraya Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.